This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You've heard of the 1%, but the number of corporations and countries who produced over 60% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is far smaller. According to our next guest, just 90 CEOs and state leaders are responsible for the majority of pollution, which is wrecking the climate. They could, Richard Heaty says, fit on two Greyhound buses. He names names, at least corporate names. I find Richard Heaty hard to describe. He's a consultant with his own company called Climate Mitigation Services. Richard has a long list of studies and reports he's published for cities and towns, mostly in the western United States. He's written short, helpful guides for consumers to understand our carbon footprint. He's a one-man carbon tracker with a warehouse mind able to reconstruct the carbon footprint of the global industrial world piece by piece, and that's quite a target. From Snowmass, Colorado, Richard Heaty, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
I'm pleased to be speaking with you, Alex.
Well, Rick, when you're doing the carbon math, why did you have to mix in a handful of countries along with those 80 or so corporations?
Well, our focus really was to trace emissions to the atmosphere back to the corporations and entities that produce the fossil fuels and cement in the first place. And for some countries, such as former Soviet Union, North Korea, Poland, and coal production in China, for example, we weren't able to construct a corporate picture, so we substituted a nation state in those few countries.
And can you name a few of the corporations who did produce the biggest impact on the atmosphere?
Well, they're the oil and gas companies we're familiar with from buying gasoline and diesel in this country, but also foreign oil and gas companies, Statoil, for example, or Total in France, Petrobras in Brazil, Saudi Aramco, and of course Saudi Arabia, and a number of Asian oil and gas companies, as well as a number of coal companies in the U.S. and around the world.
What can you tell us about the carbon role of Exxon, for example, or as it's now known, ExxonMobil?
Well, Exxon started its early days of Standard Oil, which was disbanded into seven oil and gas, well, oil majors in 1911 when the Supreme Court disbanded the Standard Oil Trust. And both Exxon and Mobil continue to this day. They merged in around 2001 to become ExxonMobil, and overall they have that company has produced 84 billion barrels of oil. And it's responsible for nearly 4% of global emissions. But when I say responsible for emissions, consumers, of course, use their product. So we have a role as responsible partners as well. But what the company is responsible for is producing the fossil fuels for decades that they know will be consumed and combusted into the atmosphere.
Now, to be fair, until about 1980 at least, this was seen as a benefit to society and that we didn't know that climate change would happen.
Well, there were scientists and other people from the 50s and 60s who recognized that there would at least be climate disruption, even if we didn't know enough about the science in the 60s to have accurately modeled the response of carbon dioxide, because we were confused about the strong role of clouds in the atmosphere, for example. But we knew there was going to be climate disruption. And in fact, President Johnson issued an environmental statement to Congress in 1965 pointing out that we knew that fossil fuels would disrupt the atmosphere. And the oil companies themselves probably engaged in, and we know Exxon did from the late 70s, and many oil companies studied climate in the 70s. And they knew that there was a problem with the products that they were in business to provide.
How do large coal companies like the recently bankrupt Peabody Coal rank in your study?
Peabody, historically, since we were able to gather data from the 1940s, I think it was, is responsible for, let me look up the data right now. Peabody ranks about 11 in all the entities, investor-owned and state-owned entities, number 11 on the list, and nearly 13 billion tons of carbon dioxide, plus a substantial amount of methane from the production of coal. So that's about 0.9% of global emissions of all industrial emissions of carbon dioxide from fossil fuels and cement.
Could you talk to us just about a couple of the countries that are on your list?
Well, China, of course, is the world-leading producer of coal. It has cumulatively over its coal production history contributed about 9% to historic emissions of carbon dioxide from 1750 to 2013. Whereas the United States, its various coal-producing entities have produced 26% of all carbon dioxide emissions from oil, gas, coal, and cement. And Peabody continues its production, although under reduced circumstances, but they have a large footprint on the Earth's climate.
You know, your report comes as a bit of a dose of reality because the press is always talking about national responsibility. We hear what each country emits and we're all guilty, and we are all guilty to some degree. But you draw back the curtain and find only a few corporate actors. What does that tell us?
Well, in my perspective, what it means is that the leaders of these corporations, including their shareholders, have a responsibility to avoid climate disaster. And we can't rely on national governments to do enough to put the proper policies in place. And I think corporate management needs to realize that their business as usual plans is a peril to the planet. And they need to adjust those plans in order to exercise proper climate stewardship and align their production of fossil fuels to the scientific goals of reducing emissions by the end of the century.
And you did include methane in your study. Why?
Because methane is associated with fossil fuel production. Of course, there are other sources of methane from livestock and agriculture and landfills, but my focus really was on the emissions that we can trace back to the corporations that produce the fossil fuels. And if a company owns an underground coal mine, for example, there's a substantial amount of methane that's typically vented through the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for oil and gas production, particularly gas production, as we're now finding out in terms of fugitive methane from oil and gas operations.
Yes, they're able to measure methane in the air from airplanes over the fracking institutions in the United States, and it's turning out to be substantial.
Yes, and from conventional oil and gas operations as well, from crude oil storage tanks, for example, from pipelines, from conventional onshore and offshore gas production, but particularly so for fracking operations.
You also included the cement industry. Why is that important, and what is it about cement making that produces so much greenhouse gases?
Well, carbon dioxide is driven off in the industrial process of heating calcium carbonate to form cement clinker that makes up cement. And globally, cement production as an industrial waste product is about 3-4% of the global carbon dioxide budget. So to the extent that we could identify some large cement manufacturers around the world large enough to meet our 8 million tons of carbon per year threshold, we would include them.
You know, until I read your study, I actually didn't understand that about the cement industry. I thought they just used a lot of fossil fuels to heat up things and burn a lot of gas to get furnaces going hot or something. I didn't realize the actual material they were working with gives off CO2.
Yes, it does. That's an inevitable byproduct of cement manufacturing. And we didn't want to include the energy inputs, which you're correct in pointing out is very energy intensive, because that carbon used to heat the kilns has already been accounted for in coal production, gas production, and other sources that the cement industry uses, whether it be electricity or direct heat.
You can't double count it.
Right.
So inquiring minds will want to know how one person could possibly accumulate the data for this study. How did you do it?
Well, it was quite comprehensive, and it took me about 12 years to gather the data. I had a lot of help from students and contributors from around the world who would go to libraries in Sydney and Johannesburg and London and Cambridge and elsewhere to find the original corporate statements about how much oil, gas, and coal they had produced in a particular year, particularly since business libraries don't have organized collections of annual reports. I had to send students around to inquire with various libraries to find the most complete collection I could. And some of the annual reports go back to prior to 1900 in the cases of some corporations that reported on annual production to shareholders. But that didn't become standard practice until the Congress passed the Securities and Exchange Commission legislation in 1933 and 1934, after which all companies were required to produce on behalf of their shareholders what they actually manufactured and extracted from the earth.
And you ended up with a scientific paper. Please tell us the title and where it was published.
It was published in Climatic Change in January 2014. And the paper is titled Tracing Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide and Methane Emissions to Fossil Fuel and Cement Producers, 1854 to 2010. And at that point, for those entities, we had accounted for 63% of all fossil fuel and cement emissions in 1750, attributed to these 90 carbon majors. And that has now risen, since we've done some updating to 2013 data, that has now risen to nearly 65% of total fossil fuel and cement emissions.
Wow. Well, speaking of studies, I noticed in your online biography the title of your thesis, A World Geography of Recoverable Carbon Resources in the Context of Possible Climate Change. That lines up with the work you've just published. When did you write that thesis?
That was a thesis I did at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, where I was going to graduate school. And that was published in 1984, and I thank NCAR for their support in that thesis. And it was got me going on early thinking of climate change and what to do about it. And after I finished my graduate degrees, I came up to work at Rocky Mountain Institute, realizing that maximizing the efficient use of fossil fuels would be one key solution to reducing the impact on climate. And here we are tracing, some 30 years later, tracing those emissions back to the corporations that will have to contribute their skill and resources to help solve the climate problem.
So you really got on it early.
I did. In fact, I had started reading when I was a student librarian in the physics library at the University of Colorado, early studies out of MIT and elsewhere, highlighting to me the future relevance of climate change and the intractability of the problem, since there were vested interests in making sure that the fossil fuel era would continue unabated. And that remains a problem to this day, and we need to align our corporations with climate stewardship so that we don't all suffer the consequences.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with my guest, the climate consultant and carbon accountant, Richard Heady from Colorado. He's found that just 90 actors are responsible for over 60% of the climate-damaging emissions to the atmosphere. I was surprised, although I shouldn't have been, to read in your study that half of all CO2 emissions in the industrial sector from fossil fuel and cement use have come just since 1988. That's shocking.
That is shocking, and if you look at the use of fossil fuels and global CO2 emissions from fossil fuels, it has such a steep rise, much faster than our population growth and in line with our financial growth over time, that it's not too surprising, really, that half of all emissions have happened since 1988, but it also points out that we now have to redouble our efforts on making targets and making good on our commitments to reduce emissions, not only with national targets and appropriate policies, but by shareholders and consumers making appropriate choices in their investments and consumption.
Part of the scary thing about that is that scientists have told us that there's a time lag of between 10 and 30 years. I've heard different figures for when you burn the emissions or release them to when you actually get the climate impacts that will be produced by them. So if we've done half the CO2 since 1988, we may be feeling it much stronger and faster than we thought.
And that seems to be the case in terms of Arctic sea ice extent and the effect on the Greenland ice sheet and possibly the West Antarctic ice sheet, that will have dire consequences if that kind of climate impact accelerates.
Well, earlier I asked you what percentage of greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to Exxon. Historically, the Rockefeller family made the greatest profits from Exxon and from Standard Oil before that. I'm wondering if I could go out on a limb and ask you to extend this carbon tracking work and really name names to get down to some of the people who have made the most from the suffering of the planet, if we want to put it that way. What about the accountability of persons?
Well, consumption of fossil fuels is ubiquitous. We all enjoy the benefits of using fossil fuels. The more we earn and spend tend to increase our emissions dramatically. And I think the individuals that earn the most on an annual basis and more or less spend the most in terms of having second and third houses, they might have a personal jet, they might have larger cars or a fleet of cars, and I think the better endowed individuals around the world have a higher responsibility to understand and cut back on their consumption of fossil fuels.
And you've worked hard enough to name corporate names. If you pulled a list of the worst offenders, say a dirty dozen, who would be some of the names on that list?
Well, we know Royal Dutch Shell, for example, is high on the list, but so are BP, of course, and ExxonMobil, as we talked about earlier, and Chevron Texaco now tops the list, historically speaking. But lesser-known entities include Gazprom in the Russian Federation, the National Iranian Oil Company, Pemex in Mexico, Coal India in India, and other oil and gas and coal companies around the world. Now, India seems committed to increasing its coal consumption over the next several decades, but they too have an opportunity to invest in greater efficient use of electricity to slow down the demand for coal-fired electricity, as well as invest in renewables as China and the United States is doing, and Germany and Denmark as well.
Now, one problem I have with your study is the amount of total greenhouse gases you allocate to those 83 companies in seven countries, namely 65% now, and perhaps I've misunderstood things, but we've had other guests, including expert guests, who suggest more than half of greenhouse gases come from the total food chain. That would include fossil fuels used by machinery and fertilizers, of course, but it also includes huge figures for changes in land use, deforestation, creation of rice paddies, and long-term carbon loss from plowing the soil. How did you arrive at such a big number for direct pollution by fossil fuel companies, or did I misunderstand your work?
No, you're understanding it fine, Alex, but I focused on fossil fuels and cement because those are the industrial sources. And I couldn't find any entities that had enough cattle around the world to qualify for the 8 million megaton carbon equivalent threshold, or a deforestation company, for example. Now, EPA data suggests that land use and forestry accounts for 11% of total greenhouse gas emissions in the current year, versus fossil fuels, about 66%. And methane from all sources, about 16%. So I focused on the big elements of the pie and focused on the sources that we can trace back to corporate entities.
I've read about a plateau in emissions at some dangerously high level, but I have a hard time believing that, seeing what's happening in China and India and Indonesia. Do you have some glimpse of what is happening now?
Well, it looks like we took a small dip in global emissions in 2015 compared to 2014. I don't know where we will stand at the end of the year 2016, but it's clear that the peak in fossil fuel and cement emissions will have to come soon, or we will completely miss our targets for 2 degrees centigrade, which we may well miss in any case, lacking international action and commitment to reduce emissions according to that science-based target, much less the Paris Accord that suggested that we should aim well below 2 degrees centigrade as our ultimate target. That's going to be very hard to achieve. So I'm putting my effort into making sure we don't exceed 2 degrees centigrade. And my new project is to develop a scenario by which an oil and gas company can align its future production of fossil fuels with a science-based target to not exceed the 2 degrees Celsius pathway to 2070. That's going to be hard for oil and gas companies to do. But with national leadership as well as corporate leadership, it can be done.
Well, I think that's one of the positive points about your study. Now we know who we have to talk to. There is a small action group who could possibly help save the planet with a rational end-of-business plan. I think they're going to have a transition over into renewable energies. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yes, we want to encourage oil and gas companies to make further commitments of capital investment and research dollars and development dollars into alternative fuels, including investing in alternative renewable portfolios to supplement their production of oil and gas, as well as to invest in carbon capture and sequestration so we can prove, and if it proves effective, to deploy that technology to offset our emissions or to at least not emit the carbon dioxide to the atmosphere in such a great degree.
On a personal note, I know you've written reports by and about Aspen, Colorado. You've been a passionate skier. Near the beginning of Radio EcoShock in December 2006, I played an interview by Betsy Rosenberg with Auden Shambler of Aspen, and then I interviewed another representative, Whistler Blackcomb, in Canada. And both resorts were really early in the game to realize global warming was a threat to their business. And I asked in my show title, "Will Global Warming End Snow Sports?" People are still skiing, though. What's your prognosis?
I think there will still be areas to ski. I've been a passionate skier all my life. I love living near Aspen and its wonderful mountains. But I'm sitting here in early November looking at fairly blank mountains. We only have a bit of snow above 11,000 feet. Now, we know snow is going to come, and we know that climate change will threaten the early and late parts of the ski season more so than the middle. So we know there will be snow, but for now we're pretty dry. And I hope that all of us, individuals as well as corporations, can tackle this climate change problem as well as I know we can.
Are you working on a book about Antarctic ice sheets?
That's on in the back of my mind constantly, is to study and to think about a scenario where we can, with fun and science, present the world with a desperate climate situation that unfolds after we have ignored climate change for decades, and a climate impact that will force us to really address the problem head on. So I'm not actively working on that, but I'm developing the science to understand what might happen to the Antarctic ice sheets and how that might present us with an urgent problem in some few decades hence.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners, Richard Heedy?
Well, I want to encourage everyone who is concerned about climate change to look at their own lifestyle choices and how they can cut their own climate change emissions. That's relatively easy in our houses with energy efficiency as well as with our transportation choices and our habits.
We've been looking at a scientific paper now 2 years old that went under the mainstream radar. Its title is "Tracing Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide and Methane Emissions to Fossil Fuel and Cement Producers, 1854 to 2010. I'll put links to the abstract in my weekly blog at ecoshock.info, and I'll add more links to helpful reviews and interviews about the world's main carbon actors. The author is Richard Heedy. He's a freelance consultant. His company is Climate Mitigation Services at climatemitigation.com. Richard, thank you so much for your hard work on this.
Well, thank you, Alex. I'm pleased to have joined you on this show, and let me also point the readers and listeners to the Climate Accountability Institute, which is my nonprofit group.
Okay, and where will they find that?
At climateaccountability.org.
Thank you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.